For as long as human beings have existed, they have sought meaning, an underlying structure to the world, and, by extension, an explanation for their own existence. Some find it in the stars, the dots of light that illuminate the night and move across the sky in a slow, seemingly purposeful procession. Others find it in nature, the plants and animals which bring them sustenance, vaulted mountains and lush forests, the deep, vast ocean.
Did he bring the music with him?
Others still find it in geometry, the recurring patterns and shapes that appear to be woven through every aspect of our universe. From the Platonic solids which Kepler used to model the solar system in Mysterium Cosmographicum, to the logarithmic spiral found in weather patterns, nautilus shells, and galaxies themselves, people found these sacred geometries everywhere they looked. In 1514, artist and philosopher Albrecht Dürer engraved his masterwork in three panels, one of which being Melancholia I. The image depicts the winged personification of melancholy, a despondent, angelic figure surrounded by haphazardly placed tools and materials. Balancing the figure in the composition is a striking geometric cube. Many have speculated on Dürer's intentions behind this shape. Does the cube, which has two corners removed, represent melancholy as a departure from Platonic ideals, the literal representation of imbalance and incompleteness? Or is the cube a more direct symbol, a blank canvas waiting to be shaped at the hand of the prone figure, the empty page waiting to be marred by the artist's mark? Regardless of his intentions, Dürer's cube became a motif adopted by other artists. In the mid-90s, the cube began appearing in paintings, one of the same name, by another German artist, Anselm Kiefer. In Kiefer's expansive works, the cube is removed from its context and placed in dark, textured spaces, dominating compositions otherwise filled with chaotic landscapes. This cube takes on a role as an object of meditation, putting the viewer in the shoes of Dürer's angel. In 2024, I began my own meditation on the cube motif. This iteration brings the viewer into a still even more intimate experience, now fully inside the cube itself.
Hey, Sam. When we asked for you to do a cube speech, we were really thinking of something a little more practical, like, you know, how much mana fixing is there, or what does removal look like?
In that case, let's welcome everybody to a very special episode of Lucky Paper Radio. My name is Andy, and I am here, as always, with my co-host, Anthony, the little creepy bug man of Baltimore, Maddox.
Yikes, I don't know what I did to deserve
that. What do you mean? We played that board game. What was the name of the board game?
Oh, yeah, House on Haunted something? On Haunted Hill?
That's a book, or a movie, or something.
House of Haunts.
I'll put it in the show notes. I don't know what the title is. I'll ask my friend and get the actual name of the board game. But it's this board game where it's like a role-playing game that has this twist where you're exploring this haunted house, and then depending on what you discover, eventually one person or multiple people are revealed as like the bad guy, and you happen to just roll bad guy, and so you end up being the traitor of the group, and you just lucked into, of like the 50 different bad monsters you can be, a bad monster that I thought was perfectly evocative of the kind of evil guy you would be if you were an evil guy.
What kind of evil guy would you be? Oh, I don't know, a giant wasp that makes swarms
of
little
wasps? You would
totally
be a scientist that is doing some experiments on bugs that goes wrong, that turns himself into a giant bug. Like, you were just straight up like insectile aberration or Delver of Secrets. Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought it was very evocative.
Unfortunately, I didn't really get a chance to make a lot of bugs. You just like high rolled twice in a row and I just died.
Still unclear if we followed the rules of that game quite exactly. Something I mentioned when we were playing this game that you take for granted when you play so much Magic is that it's really hard to write unambiguous rules to games. And the number of times I play a different board game and I read the rules completely and I'm like, well, this is just not clear. Like,
right.
This
like,
could go either
once
way.
Once a game or once a turn, I can take this action. It's like, well, can I do this action after I know whether or not you attack or defend or whatever? And it's just like not clear.
There's a reason that they have like a 400-page comprehensive rules document to cover all the edge cases, because it's really hard to write unambiguous rules text for a game. Anyway, I thought you embodied the creepy bug man perfectly.
Thanks. I did my best.
You know, not that you're creepy or a bug man, but you like bugs.
Everybody likes bugs.
No, most people don't like bugs. This is where you're wrong. A lot of people think they're weird and creepy. no more talking about your evil alter ego, though, Anthony, because we got a special guest on this episode. We are joined by someone who needs no introduction. I would call him the Roman Mars of Magic the Gathering. We've got Sam from Rhystic Studies on the line. Hey, Sam.
Hi, guys. Shout out to Mars, my favorite planet, and shout out to the Romans. not my favorite Italians, but, you know, among the Italians I enjoy. I've been biting my tongue because that game is called Betrayal.
Betrayal.
Oh, you know it. There you go. See, you should have just jumped in and interrupted us, but I appreciate it. Good.
It's Betrayal, I think, at House on Hill, but I think the two takeaways. One, I love that game, and I do believe it does struggle a little bit with branding because there's been so many derivatives of that genre or that trope of like, ooh, you're in a spooky house, you know, on the hill, as it were. I think right now they're actively trying to just call it Betrayal. If I feel like the branding has, you know, it's been repurposed many times, that board game. And I want to say now everyone's just calling it Betrayal. So really love that. And also I love how every time I try to play a game myself, Magic rules tend to like overtake, you know, yes. And you're like worried about priority and like it's like, no, it's not that deep. But I have found that teaching board games to Magic players, have you ever found it where you use like Magic language?
Yes.
You know, teaching like Pandemic, for example, I'm like, all right, this is the part where we mill these cards, and people are like, okay, I get what that means, you know.
Yeah, it can definitely be easy to have that shared language. And I've also found that if you do a little bit of digging, almost any modern board game, if you dig far enough, the designer is a Magic fan. Like, Magic really has spun off so many other games because people love the game so much. And I think it's so evocative as a game engine, and it's so clear how you can like riff on it that it ends up being like a small point of inspiration in so many other games. So
yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people, even sort of because Magic is such a big, flexible game, Magic players will take the game onto themselves to design like little mini games out of it or design cubes. And often that is the pathway to like just designing games whole cloth.
Yeah.
Yeah, the designing elements, Ryan Overturf's episode I was listening to earlier today about how Magic is the game engine. And I think that's kind of a eureka moment that folks who play Magic for a long time come to. And I believe that's very true of folks who design cubes, because your role is completely 180. You go from like a player and enjoyer and like a recipient of the game itself to thinking about it more in the terms of engine or a language. And I think that's a cool moment for every Magic player's life, but I think that's hyper accelerated if you enter the cube form at any point, especially if you're trying to design one. So I've been wearing a little bit of the game designer helmet or hats, as it were, lately, and it's so much fun. It's like reinvigorated my love for Magic.
Well, that's why we've got you on, because you've got a new cube that is out and about. Looks like you're calling it Kitchen Table All-Stars for now. Is that name locked in?
No, not at all. Kind of, we're in this like beautiful stage one of baby's first cube. And I think that name will change a couple of times. It's already changed from like the Rube Goldberg machine, which I think is kind of the spirit of it. And I found it funny that Ryan Overturf has described a couple of his cubes that way. It's like a budget synergy cube, if you want to put some formal terms onto it. But the spirit of it, I think, will be like Kitchen Table All-Stars, like the Kitchen Table Magic type of, that could be either like cards that you don't get to play with in any formats if you're a boomer like me and you want to play with Snapcaster Mage again in a somewhat semi-competitive 1v1 format, or it's just, you know, recent cards that have been excellent in retail limited that you want to see in a new context. So I think that's kind of the spirit of it, but I don't know if that's going to it's going to stay the title.
I want to take just a minute to recognize that we're living in a world where you're a boomer if you want to play Snapcaster Mage in a competitive format, because it's just not played anywhere anymore. So sad.
No, I know. I will say really quickly that there's just been this craving for me to play 1v1 Magic, and I loaded up a deck, a Reed Duke deck on Magic Online last weekend that was just Is It Wizards, and I got to play Snapcaster Mage a lot again, and it kind of overperformed given the current context and like, you know, texture of the modern format. So maybe there is hope that Snapcaster Mage makes its beautiful return to high level Magic. But again, if you don't get those chops in with Snapcaster, then maybe Cube is the final frontier of that.
Yeah, I don't know enough about any constructed meta to weigh in with any authority, but it's surprising to me that you can't find a place to play Snapcaster Mage. It seems like it should be so good. But like I said, I don't know what I'm talking about.
Well, I got harassed on Twitter by one of my favorites, Spikes, Steve Stillman, to get over it. Like, it's the year is 2024, and you're not allowed to love Snapcaster Mage anymore. So maybe that's indicative.
But, you know, that is exactly what Cube is for. Whether you're trying to play Snapcaster Mage or if you're like me and just want to cast Battle Screech, we can do that in Cube. And like you said, like, you can still do it in a semi-competitive way. It's not like...
A fully competitive way if you want.
A lot of other formats are casual and let you do whatever you want, but you can't necessarily take that mentality of trying to win because you're opting into playing in sort of a de-optimized way. And I think that's really the beautiful thing about Cube, that it can do both of those things at the same time.
Yeah, there's a certain playing along that I appreciate about Cube. It's hard to say. It feels like improv comedy in that way, where you're kind of going with the bits just a little bit, where maybe you do choose to live the dream or make a kind of wacky contraption Frankenstein's monster deck because you do want to play along with the spirit of the cube that's presented in front of you. Some folks will just play fully optimally, which is fine, but I'm hoping that when I get to draft this thing that people are excited to, like, you know, play some unoptimal cards. Like, one of my dream goals is just to play Organ Hoarder again, right? It can start as simple as that. Like, I just want to play with the card Organ Hoarder. So where can I do that? It's like, well, we can, you know, go with the episode you spoke about with, like, finding a card like Trade Routes and just designing based on the vibes of one specific card and seeing where those tangents take you. And that's kind of the spirit of this cube and this format that I want to curate is getting excited about cards that really have no home otherwise.
If there is no home for Organ Hoarder, we shall build it and it shall be glorious.
Yeah. there's kidneys and hearts and lungs on the wall. Like, this is the home for it.
Yeah, I guess maybe I don't want a home for an Organ Hoarder specifically, but metaphorically, we'll take it. I think you've already said quite a bit about what has drawn you to this cube. You've said you wanted to play more 1v1 Magic. You've had a sort of desire to do that. And you're looking to play with these specific older cards. I get the sense this is also a design exercise for you, correct?
Yeah, it's really satisfying the itch that's like EDH used to fill for me.
Yeah.
I've crafted some wacky EDH decks in the past year because for two reasons. One, I go on these shows where I have to build decks and, you know, play them or whatever. And I tend to just build, not so much a joke deck, but we have this motto that we're adhering to is like build for the bit. And we also have a small play group at these Magic Cons where in the group text, like a couple months before we go to the Magic Con, someone will just lay out a prompt. Like the last one, we went to Chicago and the prompt was layers. Or sorry, it was the cold. It was the cold. And you're allowed to take that prompt and build whatever deck you want. I said layers because my friend Tyler built what I thought was the most creative version of that deck. And he built a layers based EDH deck. It was very cool. He brought little cue cards for us to remind us of all the layers of Magic.
I was going
to
say layers like in the rules, like the low level rules component that underpins all of the stack and priority and everything.
Well, it's not the stack. It's the order in which static abilities get applied, right?
Exactly right. It was great because, like, he's like, oh, if it's cold, you're going to need layers to bundle up, you know? And so he built the layers deck. So that's the spirit of the EDH, like, kind of that I want to still play. But I think Cube is kind of an extension of that, where the rule zero of Cube is you get to build a draft environment or a large scale format that allows you to play Magic in the way that you want to play it. So EDH for a long time was that for me, but Cube has always been the end game for me. Like at the very beginning of Magic, or I learned Magic playing Cube and EDH, which is kind of a hard way to do it.
Yeah.
They're both like singleton formats and they're both adhering to like different rule sets just fundamentally than your normal Magic set. But I was always enamored by folks who could build EDH decks. And more than that, folks who could build whole entire draft formats. I've always found that to be, like, again, the end game. Like, that's the end goal. I want to get good at Magic such that my backwards knowledge of the game and my inner knowledge of the game allows me to create a draft format. So anytime I have an excuse to play Cube, like at these Magic Cons, I'm always trying to find someone with a Cube. You know, we could wax poetic forever about the beauty of Cube. But fundamentally, I was like, all right, I've been playing Magic 10, 11, 12 years consistently. It's time. Like, I have to sit down and finally do this thing that I've wanted to do for so long, which is build a cube. And I've been sick for a week and I was bedridden and it just felt like the right time to do it, you know?
I mean, it's funny how much, like, if we're to make that an even bigger statement, so many people started cubes at the beginning of the pandemic, which is similar. It's just like, well, we're at home, we got time.
Yeah, for those of us that didn't play digital Magic, it was like, well, if I can't play Magic, I might as well figure out a way to think about it constantly, right? It'll be like the manifestation of my love of this game will have to be just thinking really hard about it for a while until I can get back out in the real world and actually slinging spells again.
Yeah, there's just such a like a high barrier entry to cube, I think, more than any other type of Magic and format. And I've always, again, admired the folks who put together cubes and think about cubes. And I've always wanted to be part of that group, you know, part of that club. And this is my first foray into it as a cube enjoyer and, you know, on the other side of the table, as it were. Now I'm trying to champion. It's almost like you're in D&D and one day you finally decide like, all right, it's my turn to DM, right? That's kind of what I think cube feels like.
That's a very apt metaphor, I think, in so many ways, right? And I think we found that like growing our local playgroup is a bit of a, you know, side tangent here, but I think it's part of what we found in growing our local playgroup is that, you know, the fact that cube as a format kind of requires somebody in that sort of DM informal leadership role is also hugely beneficial to actually growing a group, right? Like if you just have a bunch of people that like playing Modern or whatever, it's hard to have like a focus or like a way to actually make that group larger or like expand or like, you know, kind of centralized around. But if you have a couple people with cubes, then they have a motivation to actually like grow their local community. And that connection between the format and the actual like community of people you play with is a very beautiful thing to me.
It is, and it's a dying art to be a host and a herder of cats, you know. And of course, that's the eternal plague of the cube designer and host, is that harder than all of these exercises that we can riff about forever is just getting eight people in the same room together. So, and I found myself lucky that recently we've cobbled together a group of players and we get to, you know, get to play Magic basically once a week with some folks who don't really play Magic but know how to play, and other folks like me who are really enfranchised players. And I'm like, okay, well, I have more or less a consistent play group. And we've been playing a lot of set cubes that my buddy Luke has been putting together. And those have been really entertaining and fun. But that was one of the goals for my cube, is like, I want this thing to be something that I can play with all of my friends who are like more or less Magic novices. They're still discovering how the game works fundamentally at the mechanical level, the rules level. But I could also take that box to these Magic cons that I'm at every 3 months and play with the sickos, as it were, right? Mm-hmm. So I wanted something that could be in both realms. And one of the goals that I found like enchanting from reading about cube on Cube Cobra was like, well, you can just choose cards that are more or less still follow that rule of like reading the card explains the card. And I was like, that's I love that. I love that as just like a, you know, a bullet point on my list of goals. I want cards that look like Magic cards more or less and do what they say on the front. That's a beautiful limitation to put on. And it's because I want to play with two separate play groups, more or less.
I really love your idea that like this is kind of the apotheosis of Magic for you. You've been growing as a player and playing for a long time and kind of building up this reserve of energy and knowledge that you're then going to dump into this project. I do want to weigh in just for anyone listening that I agree that I think cube is intimidating, probably the most intimidating way to play Magic, because it's so much bigger just in terms of raw number of cards and more expansive than like building your own deck. And I think a lot of people worry that if they like do a bad job, it won't be fun and they'll like mess it up. And well, I want to like echo everything you said about this being a like beautiful place to dump a bunch of energy and knowledge and experience. I think it also could be a lot more approachable for a lot of people. And if you actually just sat down and pretty much gathered the cards you liked and maybe like made a few concessions to curve and put a couple more fixing lands in than you would naturally pull out of a box, you could have a pretty darn good cube to actually just play the game with. So I just want people that are listening to you to not think, I got to wait till I'm Sam level of experience with this game before I can actually build a cube.
100%. And the exercise feels very much like a creative project, and that's, you know, the old adage of the hardest part is just getting started. I've always believed that about cube design, and I've always known that, like, okay, you just have to get some ideas on a piece of paper or in an Excel sheet or on Cube Cobra or whatever. Like, just put some cards on the table, and then it just becomes this beautiful like snowball effect of you do have something to look at. You have something tangible to say, oh my God, that's a card and that's an idea and that's an archetype. And now how do I tinker with it? And then it just takes care of itself. Like, the momentum is there. no doubt I'm going to be finicking with this cube for the next year in my downtime or at these events. So I think that is also true that, like, no, there is no sense of, you don't need to have played Magic for 5 years before you can build your cube. One of the riders on Cube Cobra has only been playing Magic 3 or 4 years. I'm like, that's so impressive that you're already in the deepest end of Magic in my eyes, and you're building cubes and writing about cubes. Like, that's so sick. I love that you love the game to that extent. And then secondly, like, yeah, it is just about choosing a card. Like, pick one specific card that might be the seed of your entire cube, and it can go and blossom from there. So I found, again, your episode on trade routes was the final push for me of like, oh, I can do this. You just choose a card, and then the snowball forms.
I love that it's Organ Hoarder too. That feels so flavorful of just like, let's go grab the components to start with, and then we can build from there.
It is really, it's Organ Hoarder is going to be, it might even be the Organ Hoarder cube at the end of the day. Like, that might be the favorite. It's still one of my favorite, all-time favorite cards. Another inspiration for this cube is just that, like, Retail Limited in the past few years has been so, so good and so much fun. And my favorite formats in the past few years have felt like cubes all their own. So that's kind of this, that's also part of the mishmash of this cube is like, a lot of these cards that are in it are pieces of archetypes from recent limited sets that I've just enjoyed playing.
Yeah, some we've talked about before, and we don't play a ton of limited anymore ourselves, but even just at pre-release or like the occasional draft here and there, I think some of the recent sets have really felt very cube-esque. I especially think about like Phyrexia All Be One with all those, like, I mean, I forget even what the additional cards that were included in that set were called, but the fact that there was like effectively a much bigger card pool you could open, and then you would open like a Griffin Airy, and it's like, okay, but this is not in the set, but it does actually key off of the same kind of themes that are present in the set, and like, how do I actually make this now a draft that's about this one card that I had this like vanishingly small chance of actually opening? Definitely felt like it had kind of cube-esque vibes.
Yeah, Brothers War was really indicative. I think Brothers War and March of the Machine were the two more recent ones where that really came to fruition. But Brothers War specifically, because it was an artifact set,
right,
all of the schematic artifacts were pretty low impact cards, but they were the glue that tied a lot of those decks together in a cool way. There were just a lot of dinky artifacts like Chromatic Star or Ichor Wellspring or whatever that were so fun to open and tinker with. So Brothers War does have an influence on this cube too for that exact reason.
There's a couple places I want to go with this. So first, I want to talk about this place we are at with this cube right now, because over the years, I think we have spilled a lot of ink on how to like get over the hump to design your first cube, because that is something that so many people find hard to do. I think we've also talked a lot about iterating on a cube and how you like process feedback from drafts and things like that. But you're kind of in this liminal space that we have not talked about, but I think is actually a very important space to be, where like you've put it all together and you're not kind of itching to get your first playtest session in. I'm curious to know, how are you making decisions about what changes to make before you've even gotten a chance to actually play this cube at all?
I forget who I was listening to. Maybe it was on one of your shows or if it was an article who was describing that there is this moment where you have, let's say you're aiming for about 450 cards and you do have 450 potential cards to make this thing real. And before you hit buy now on some of those cards you're missing, you do make more changes. And I was like, I would love to see that. And it's very true. It's like having your first draft of a video script done and you read it through and you're like, oh my gosh, I have to edit significant parts of this to make it coherent. So I've been in that space a little bit. I think another valuable tool is just the fact that I could post to Twitter and I'd get a lot of folks who are ready to do a quick draft of it and write up some responses. I got a lot of good feedback there. But there is about 20 to 30 cards that I cut from what I felt was like, this is my cube, you know, ready to hit by now. And then I go to sleep and I wake up the next morning and folks are like, you have to take Thundermaw Hellkite out of this cube. I'm so sorry, but the goals that you have are not lining up with that card. And I'm like, damn it. You're,
I mean,
so
then you just
right.
Need to update the goals and say, goal, play Thundermaw Hellkite.
Yeah. And it's like, oh, you're so right. So one of the most valuable pieces of information, these are those tough pills to swallow where you're, there's something so vulnerable about cube too, where you really want people to like it and you really want people to see the vision. And then they come back and say, your vision is not aligning with your choices. And it's like, ah, you're right, but I'm not ready to hear that yet, you know? So I got a couple of comments like that. You sleep on it and you wake up and you're like, okay, they are right. So you chop off one of the more valuable ones were like, how do you want games to end? Like, if you want this to be a synergy cube, then you can't have the payoffs just be generically good cards. Like, they can't be in a vacuum just cards you would play no matter what. And a lot of my top end threats were like that. So I cut a few of the angels, I cut a couple of the dragons in red, because I could see exactly what they were pointing at. Like, if you want games, early and middle games, to matter, you can't then just have the red player cast Thundermaw Hellkites, because that just nullifies the little Rube Goldberg machine that you've put together. So they were like, well, then take your top end threats and make them payoffs for the synergies themselves. So you swap out, and I know this sounds almost blasphemous, you take out Thundermaw Hellkite, and you add the Kami from the recent Neon Dynasty, the one that enters and it regrows an artifact.
Kami of Industry, yeah.
Correct. So I'm like, oh, that's the payoff I was looking for. And that's another Eureka moment. And it's one of those like, okay, now we have to test it to see how good that card is. But I just love the potential of that card to be the one that, like, there's two things. One, I want the player casting it to feel so smart and happy to cast that card because it's not good on its own, right? So there's first goal. And then the second goal is I want to be on the other side of the table from that card and say, that was sick, but I can beat it, right? One of my least favorite limited sets recently was Crimson Vow, because every card didn't matter if you just hit one of those bombs. Or maybe like Toxril, you know, from, I think that was also Crimson Vow. Like, the games are just totally nullified because of the power of some of these cards. And I don't want that to happen in my cube. I really do want the top end threats to feel really satisfying to play, but also feel like, as the opposing player, that you can beat that thing.
There may be some places where it's considered blasphemous to cut Thundermaw Hellkite for Kami of Industry, but that is not this place for sure. We are all aboard the cutting the generically powerful stuff for things that are more synergistic.
Yeah, I mean, as an aside, I'm also just super, super heartened to hear that that's the kind of feedback that you're getting, and I think really points to, or just is revealing to me, that the Cube community has changed a lot since I got into this, where the feedback you're getting is not put in this card that's more powerful, but it's like, hey, what do you really, like, how do you want games to end is such a great question to be asking. So that's super exciting for me to hear.
The feedback has been similar to what it felt like submitting your essay in grad school or even, you know, in college.
Perfect.
Where they don't point to the answers. They just point to the questions. You know, it's such a rhetorical question that they're proposing instead, and it leads the horse to water. And that's so much fun. It's like, thank you for providing feedback that isn't so explicit. It's more implicit, and it might lead me to the answers that also make me feel very smart for discovering on my own, you know? And I don't mean to belittle the person that's commenting this way, but it feels so parental, like, you know? And I love that. I'm appreciative of that.
We've definitely gotten the feedback that this podcast feels like auditing in a graduate school class. So I think we're all on the same page here. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think a lot of that comes from how you've presented the cube too, right? You present it in a very clearly articulated set of goals, which makes a big difference to how people perceive it, instead of just being like, why are you not simply playing the most powerful cards? Which, I mean, to your point, Anthony, you know, 5-6 years ago, if you were talking about cube anywhere, that was pretty much what the conversation was. It was either that or it was that rarity restricted, and you were talking about the most powerful cards at uncommon or common. And I do think it's way more normal now for people just to be like, yeah, I have my own set of goals. I'm making my house of organ grinder. And so you can come help with that if you want, or, you know, just buzz off if all you're going to do is tell me to add lightning bolt.
I will say that cubes also, maybe you've discussed this before, but I also want to make a cube that is somewhat memorable, either because of the cards themselves or the promise of the vibe of the experience we're about to sit down and have. Like, thinking back to all the cubes I've drafted, I love drafting a good, really well-tailored legacy or power cube. Those cubes tend to blend together in the specificities of the cards that are in there. You know, you've drafted legacy so many times, you're like, okay, I know I'm going to take Oath of Druids here and force that, and then we're going to have games. So much so that, like, actually playing the game sometimes feels less exciting than drafting the deck, right? And that's kind of a symptom, I think, of generically powerful cubes and cards that you put in a cube. Over time, you're like, these start to blend together. The most memorable cubes I've ever played are these wacky, not even wacky, but just so off the beaten path cubes where Feld into the Third Path is one of the best cards. Or, you know, like, skulk is a keyword that matters. Like, that to me is way, like, ooh, this perks me up in a totally different way. And I think that cube in general is just a frontier of exploring all those things. I mean, your recent episode on 100 Thopters, I'm like, this is so sick. Like, this is a new, within the game design language that is Magic, we found a whole new expression of that. And I would love to sit down and draft that because it's like a dialect of that language.
Well, I am building it in paper, so next time you find yourself in Baltimore or we find ourselves at a Magic event together, you can play 100 Ornithopters if you want.
I'm looking for them. There's a lot of Magic cards
they're
on this
all right
table.
Here.
Okay,
they're all in this box. Yeah, and I got to clean up my office a little bit. It's a little bit mad scientist laboratory down here.
My goal is just to name one of them. I love that you're also going to twist it even further and give all these little robots names.
It'll only take a few hundred finished drafts for us to name them all. We'll see how long that takes.
So I'm curious sort of about two things about the first playtest of this. One aspect is just like, do you have a playtest plan? Do you have like a specific group of people that you're going to try and get feedback from? And also, what feedback are you looking for? Like, what questions do you have going into playing this for the first time?
Yeah, I think the feedback will come from both of my intended audiences. One just being our very informal, for fun play group that we have, cobbled together every Wednesday night. Because that feedback is going to feel so different from the Magic Con type of folk, or I've kind of joined recently a Discord channel that focuses, I'm in Austin, so focus specifically on people that are interested in playing Cube in Austin. And the people that are in that are going to be more of the
the sickos.
You and Andy's.
You can
the
say
world.
The sickos. Yes.
The sickos in the best way. I love championing the sickos, right? So I love that I'm going to get two totally different realms of feedback. I also am excited just to see what the first 3-0 deck looks like, because you can kind of start tracking the 3-0 decks. On Cube Cobra, I had not been familiar with the website, so I did not know that people could do a mock draft of your cube for one, and then two, you would get the results of that.
Yeah.
So I've already started to feel like in a vacuum, people are drafting white a lot. So I'm curious about, like, because it's the most obvious and proactive strategy or baseline, and some of the cards are obviously stronger than the other colors. I'm excited to see what the balance of that looks like in a real human draft of eight people. You know, if someone lands in the white deck, well, what does the natural flow look like over the course of a draft? So stuff like that, like what is a really cool 3-0? Maybe there's an obvious 3-0 deck, but what if there's a not obvious 3-0 deck? One of the writers I keep mentioning on Cube Cobra is just takes photos of the 3-0 decks and posts them. And I think that's its own cool exercise in terms of feedback. So that's the stuff I want. And I'm also excited to like go through this maze, this labyrinth, you know, with a cube like that. Maybe pack one, pick one isn't so obvious. Like, what am I going to take? What, you know, what dream do I want to live in this cube? So stuff like that is what I'm stoked for. Like, just as much the draft as the playing of it, but also the reception. You know, you have created a scenario where everyone at the table, it's their birthday and you want to give them a gift. And that's kind of the charm of being the host of Cube.
Your point about how you want games to end and that being an important question, I think is very salient. It sounds like you've really been doing your research, but a cube I do want to point you to, if you haven't looked at it by chance in that space, is Caleb Gannon's Powered Synergy Cube from now, I guess like 2 years ago is when it was on MTGO. Time really does fly. But the explicit goal of that cube was still playing many of Magic's most powerful cards, like, you know, power as the name implies, make sure that the vast majority of games are decided by synergy instead of raw power outliers. And, you know, we could nickel and dime specific card inclusions and whether or not they are entirely in line with that goal. But I think, broadly speaking, especially if you watch the leagues that, I guess they're not leagues technically, the drafts that Caleb did and post to his YouTube channel and the decks that were successful, I think he pretty much succeeded in that goal of still making sure that your deck couldn't just win because you happened to get to 5 mana and cast your Thunderball Hellkite, but instead because you had to combine cards in novel ways.
I think that I'm going to echo Jim LePage's famous saying here, who plays a lot of EDH. One of his favorite, you know, moments in a game is like, he always says like, oh, it's getting pretty late. And what that means is like, all right, we should probably end this thing. I think that's also kind of dangerous when you build cubes like this, where if we flatten out that power band and we narrow it, I've played cubes where all the cards are more or less relatively strong in comparison with one another, that it does get hard to end games. And that's also a risk that you run. So part of the feedback I'm excited about is like, okay, what do the end of games actually look like? Does someone take a clear advantage so much so that the opponent can scoop, you know? Because if If not, then maybe we run into a scenario where every game takes an hour and a half and you sit and you cube for 8 hours, which might not be realistic in some of these things that we're trying to do. So yeah, so I don't know. I'm kind of worried about that as a potential problem of games not actually being able to end effectively if you have too many cards that depend on other cards to do the thing. So
I think that's one of the most beautiful things about designing a cube and getting to play it for the first time is all of the decks and interactions and matchups kind of live in your head as this like distribution, this like abstract cloud of relationships and, you know, things might be favored or not favored. And then as soon as a game actually gets played, it's like you get to realize one possible path of all those cards and like the game will end, right? Like somebody's going to win the first game and it'll be with some cards you put in there for that explicit purpose. And it's just so fun to like actually see that take form after being purely abstract in your head for so long.
Yeah, I mean, I'll say it's also fun. I think it is inevitable that you will be surprised by some things. And I'm just thinking back to the very first draft of my own cube, which I remember pretty well. And I mean, I don't want to heap more fear onto it, but everything you're describing that you were afraid of definitely happened to me. And it's like, oh, here's somebody over here that's drafting, you know, this ridiculous five color deck and they're getting the spell back every turn with this card and looping this. And by the way, they're still on game one, even though everybody else is finished. And it's like, oh, no, nothing is working. And it was both like, yeah, there were things that didn't work, but it was very easy to identify with the, well, and then skip forward 3 years, and I think my cube's a lot better, but it did, it was
quite
like
a bit more than 3 years,
a
but yeah.
lot of iteration. Yeah, and it was solved 3 years ago, and it's been all good since
okay,
then.
Okay, good, there you go.
But yeah, I mean, you'll learn a lot very quickly, and it is just really interesting to see where are those things that don't play in the way that you actually expected.
That's already been a charming part of reflecting on these drafts, these submitted mock drafts on Cube Cobra, is folks kind of showing one of the charms, I guess, from designing is like, oh, what you intended might not be visible or what actually manifests in the Frankenstein's monster. And I've already seen that in the mock drafts where combinations of cards that I did not expect, in my eyes, they're like blending two archetypes that I thought were opposites of one another. And you kind of look at the nitty gritty of it and you're like, oh, they saw something totally different than what I saw when I included this card. And that to me is like the most fascinating and why I want to get the draft. The absolute best part. You're like, oh my gosh, you're going to play with a card that I meant for the blue-black control deck. You're going to put that in the green-white deck like as a splash? Like, let's go. What does that look like?
I mean, that's literally when it crosses over into game design, right? Where you are setting the boundaries, but you're not prescribing exactly what people are going to do, which I would argue doesn't even happen in, like, you know, EDH deck construction, right? Like, maybe you find a combination that you didn't quite expect, but you still put all those cards in that deck because they related to each other. And here you are just building a system of tools, and then people are set loose on it with their own perspectives, their own values, their own way of seeing the game. And the result of that collaboration is it's just the best part of cube design by far.
100%. And I've been in those seats, too, where I find the card or a combo or a new idea, and it feels awesome on both sides, as both the designer but also the player. And you know, Magic is about feeling smart, and it rewards you for feeling smart and smarter than the design or the engine itself. So I want to create that. I want people to feel smart and not just like, well, it's turn five, I'm gonna smash Thundermaw and win now, you know.
Man, I'm looking at a deck that I drafted of this, and I don't know why I'm not playing Lingering Souls in this green-white deck. Speaking of playing a black card in your green-white deck, I don't feel smart right now.
Lingering Souls is a black card, silly.
I know.
Silly bean.
Lingering Souls is probably a problem card, but it's one of those pet cards that you want to see how it kind of shakes out, and it might be too strong, but I don't fault you for not playing that in the white deck.
As you go back through the archives, if you start listening to back episodes of this show, you will hear the many years that Anthony played Lingering Souls in his cube, even though it was a huge power outlier, because you
but
just liked the card.
Everybody smiled when they cast it, and that was the important thing.
As long as you look at the one side of the table when it's being cast,
right,
it's all smiles every time.
Well, in Thundermaw was included in part, you know, as it was originally designed to kill Lingering Souls. And so now we have a power vacuum on the other side. Maybe Lingering Souls is too good. And now we're in the infinite maze that is balance, right?
Yep. Get lost in there forever. I want to draw attention to a couple things you're saying, just to reiterate them. Because, so again, you're in this kind of liminal space where you've spent a lot of time thinking about this cube. It is not just a pile of cards that interest you. You've already been over it a couple times and, you know, thought about balance and how you want your archetypes to be shaped. And the fact that you're saying that there's still a huge value to you just like going to bed, waking up the next day, and looking at the list again with your goals in mind to just continue to go over it, I think is really valuable. And for anybody in that position where you've got your first cube and you're like, I guess it's good enough to play test, what do I do next? You can just play test it, or you can, like you said, just kind of, you know, over time, keep taking passes with that same lens, because in a new day, a new context, you might see a card and say, actually, you know, I thought this card was synergistic and an answer to Lingering Souls, but it turns out it's just a bomb that ends the game. So going over your list with those goals, you know, at the forefront of your mind, I think is a very valuable thing to do.
Yeah, it's also the writing process. I mean, every script I ever write, no matter what, I will rest on it and test it again the next day. There's been so many instances when I'm making a video that is the not just the objectively correct thing to do, but it's one of the more rewarding pieces of feedback you can give yourself. Because if you sit and write for 3 hours, what you're writing is not going to read the same the next day. So that's it. It's really easy to get excited in those moments where you feel like you hit gold. Typically, though, it's most of the time it's fool's gold and it needs a little refinement, you know? So I think I'm still just applying that sort of methodology or workflow to this because I'm treating it again like a creative project. Yeah, so being patient is really, really important when it comes to this stuff.
Definitely. I mean, speaking of sort of the creative process, I was just listening to your interview on Humans of Magic, and something that I thought was interesting that you mentioned, because I really sort of empathized with it, was the way that when you finish a project, you very much feel done with it and ready to move on, which, you know, makes a lot of sense that you're sort of more focused on the process than the outcome. So once it is published and out there, it is not as appealing to you, right? It's sort of like it's done. Do you feel like this cube is a similar thing, or do you think it's going to be a continually evolving project?
It's tricky because I already do feel the pull to make another one. And I know that's probably
true. That was going
to
be my next question is what's the next cube?
Yeah, it does feel like that because some of the ideas I've scrapped away, it's like, well, I still have to find a place to put Thundermaw Hellkite. I really want to cast that card. And if it's not in this cube, you know, then which one is it? I think that my hope is that because I do suffer from that symptom of like boredom once the idea is fully realized, I hope that this doesn't feel that way because of the feedback loop that it promises. You know, in many ways, when a video is done, it does not feel like mine anymore. And I've kind of explored the idea and I feel satisfied with the way it turned out. You know, you bake the cake and then people eat it and you go on to the next cake. I'm hoping that this, because of the promise that it is, you know, an eternally redraftable environment, that after the first one, I'm just going to want to revisit it right away. That's the goal. And if not, then like maybe the ideas aren't as, you know, evergreen as I thought they would be.
I think you'll find yourself coming back to it. For me, I have definitely felt like seasons of interest in a cube. And then sometimes I'll hang it up for a little while. And by hang it up, I mean, if it's a cube I have in paper, I'll just keep playing it, right? Because obviously, if you have a cube you can play, that doesn't have to always be a design project. But then I'll get something stuck in my craw where it's like a different type of thing I want to capture or something I want to change about it. And then the whole process kind of starts over again. And you start piling up new cards in the maybe board that might address this new problem or express this different aspect of the game that you otherwise hadn't captured prior. And you're just kind of like ebb and flow, and you'll keep returning back to it and making a big batch of changes. Maybe you hang it up for a while. And I can sympathize so much with the multiple cube thing. Honestly, maybe my biggest level up moment as a cube designer, well, one of them at least, was when I built my second cube. And I was like, okay, whew, no longer does my one cube have to be everything. Because for a long time, it was like, that's where I got to put all the stuff that I want to do in drafted one-on-one Magic, because that's my one cube. And as soon as I had a second one, it was like, all right, woof, I can take this card out of here. This card actually does not belong at all and has never belonged. It was just like shoehorned in here because I want to play it somewhere. And so the fact that you're already figuring that out means you're like 20 steps ahead of where I was at my first cube, at least.
Yeah, and it does come from EDH. I think EDH does have that same process where some decks you're like, oh, this is something I could play forever. Some decks were a cool fleeting idea that you get bored of once it's 100 cards and sleeved and you jam it for a couple times. And then similarly, like, I was tasked recently with rebuilding my first EDH deck, and luckily I still had the list. You come back to it after 10 years, you're like, God, this is an abomination. Like, this is so bad in so many ways that I know now from experience. The cube, I think, has already kind of promised a similar retrospective or reflection in 5 years. When I look back on this cube, I'm like, yeah, that was definitely baby's first cube, you know?
I love that you keep saying that. My wife's cube is actually called Baby's First Cube, and she's had it for like 3 or 4 years now, but it's still just Baby's First Cube on Cube Cobra.
I love that. Shout out to your wife. I feel like I'm in the same spot, you know?
So we're talking a lot about sort of the cards that you're really excited to play with, and this cube being a space to be able to play with them. Aside from Organ Hoarder, what are the other kind of benchmark cards that you're really hoping to shine here?
Pearl Lake Ancient is a card I can't wait to cast. I just really want that to be the control finisher, and I hope that there's a world where someone casts Pearl Lake Ancient, flashes it in, and wins the game. I've always had a soft spot for that in terms of, you know, your classic control finishers. It appeared in a blue-black, I think, control deck in Khans of Tarkir Standard for just a little bit as Aetherling rotated out of RTR. I have an affinity with that card. I should look more at the list. I think, yeah, Pearl Lake Ancient is up there.
That's a great example, I think, of a card to be like a hallmark or focal card, because it speaks to the way games are meant to end, obviously, and the fact that it is a huge closer. It lends itself to a particular style of deck, given that it has flash and it's like really resilient, but also slow, especially by Modern Magic standards. So, you know, you want to play in a deck with a bunch of counter spells and answers and removal, a more typical control deck. And then it even has that sort of last bit where you can return 3 lands. Let's just read the rules real quick. For those that don't know, Pearl Lake Ancient is a 7-mana 6/7. It's a Leviathan. It's got flash. It can't be countered. It has prowess. So just a big, giant flash prowess threat. And then it has the ability to return 3 lands you control to their owner's hands, return Pearl Lake Ancient to its owner's hand. So you can bounce your lands and then, you know, at most 3 turns later, redeploy your Pearl Lake Ancient, and it is very resilient. But that fact that you return lands to your hand is another cool opportunity to be one other sort of node to then key off of and think about all the cards that fit with that. The, like, cycling lands or the legendary cycle from Kamigawa Neon Dynasty where you can channel them to get some other kind of effect, like other kinds of lands you want to play and pick up, your Sheldock Isles or whatever that have other end of the battlefield abilities.
Something trade routes.
And then maybe trade routes, you know. But yeah, the fact that it has that stapled to it, it makes it such a great card to be like one of the focal points of the cube.
Yeah, I'm fascinated if that, well, that to me looks like a card that could easily be cut or just is always in the sideboard, and I hope that's not the case. I'll celebrate with either myself or whoever cast that for the first time, because I think that'll be a big moment. I mean, 7 mana is a lot of mana, you know, even in cube. So shout out to Pearl Lake Ancient. I think another one is Nyx Weaver. It's 1 black-green for a 2/3 reach spider. It's an enchantment creature. And it says at the beginning of your upkeep, put the top 2 cards of your library into your graveyard. And then it has an activated ability for 1 black-green where you can exile it and return a card from your graveyard to your hand. So it has that Eternal Witness regrowth type attached to it. This is like a super slow engine. It's a card that harkens back to the cube that I learned Magic on, and specifically Jan, who decided to include it when Journey into Nyx previewed, and he was like, I want to test this in the cube. I remember that moment so well because it spoke to his like eternal tinkering with the cube and always like curiosity, and almost like he had such an innocent perspective on Magic cards in that way. Like a pure, like, I want to just test this. Like, let's just give it a whirl. Over time, I think folks, you know, you start to like lean into your preferences or you evaluate a card like, oh, you need to dismiss it really fast. I think eternally, like, Magic players are just in general really bad at evaluating Magic cards in a vacuum.
Oh, yeah.
You know, previews and formats continue to prove that to us, you know. So I just loved that he was like, yeah, I want to test it. So he put it in the cube and he tested it. So I'm in the same position. Like, maybe Nyx Weaver is good in this cube. Maybe it's not. I also love it because, speaking to the playgroup I most often play with, they really have learned drafts through the lens of signpost uncommons, like gold signpost uncommons. And that's exactly what this card is in there for. If you look at this card in the vacuum and you're a newer player to the cube, at least you know, you have an idea that Black-Green is wanting to do this graveyard sacrifice thing, you know? And I really hope that that kind of inspires a deck building path while they're drafting. So that card is just pulling a lot of weight for me in a lot of ways, and it might not be good or it might be perfect, you know? And that's kind of the fun of looking at a card like that, because it's so hard to evaluate in this vacuum.
The other thing that's great about it is you can get a few drafts deep and realize that Nyx Weaver and Pearl Lake Ancient actually aren't very good, and maybe they're not serving your goals. And you can choose to just cut them and pursue the other goals that the cube has, or you can choose to cut all the stuff that's better than them until they're good again. And, yes. You know, just make the environment, like, force the environment to be what you want it to be in that sense.
Yeah, and I think that I've learned also from reading these articles is, like, you shouldn't, you know, sample size is going to start to matter. Your first draft is not going to be the say-all, end-all for certain cards.
Definitely not.
It's probably matured to not really change too much after the first draft, because your results might skew in one way that they don't reappear, you know, in the fifth draft when folks have more familiarity with the cube, or packs shake out differently or whatever. There's so much variance that you can't really, like, cut 20 cards after the first draft, right? That'll be a new muscle to exercise too, which is not true typically with EDH. After EDH, you're like, okay, this card was just super bad and I was not excited to see it. Or this card was, you know, overtook the game and it's clearly part of the deck forever. So yeah, I'm excited to kind of see how that shakes out as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's a much more difficult challenge, to be honest, than just making choices about cards as a player, because it's a relatively simple question to answer. Was this card good in my deck or not? Compared to, is this card having a positive impact on the play experience of all of these other cards?
Yeah, totally.
And to your point, I do think making any decisions based on the results of the first draft, like the records or whatever, is probably not that useful in almost all circumstances. But I do think it is possible to learn very concrete things about specific cards from that first draft. You know, sometimes you can just talk to players and realize, like, or even yourself have the experience of being like, okay, every time I resolved this card, I won, and it felt like there was nothing my opponent could have possibly done. And maybe I still went 1-2 because I got mana screw the times I didn't draw this card, but we all had the experience in-game, the qualitative experience of being like, oh, this is impossible to answer. There's nothing on this cube that can possibly hang with this. And that can still inform a direct cut, even if it doesn't directly map to the outcome of the draft per se or whatever. It's a lot about the feeling, right? The feeling of, like, when they played that bomb, did you feel like you could beat it? Or did they play that bomb and then you just felt like the rest of the cards in your deck didn't matter and everything that happened in the game prior to that was irrelevant?
Yeah, and I think that there will be even a sense of that from the novice players, which I love.
Oh, for sure.
Which I think that they will key into certain cards that and make valuable observations about those cards even without the context of the cube at large. So of course I'll be perking up about that, and I'm hoping that that's not the case, because again, it speaks to the central goal of this cube, which is every card matters and no card is indestructible, right? Literally speaking, and also you know figuratively speaking in the course of a game.
You've got Purphoros in here.
I know. Don't look at Purphoros. Other than Purphoros, don't look there.
You know,
right?
That as soon as you said that, Anthony's typing, you know, O indestructible into the
correct
filter.
Purphoros is such an obviously glaring bat, like, super good card in this cube. I want someone to go off with it. It's just, you know, it's part of, like, all right, at the end of the day, I still feel like Perf is a pet card, and I want someone to hit that payoff. It's such a jackpot type of card. So we'll see how powerful it is ultimately. But yeah, he is my only concession to the keyword indestructible. I wish he
right,
didn't
have what about
have
Colossus of Akros? Should we talk about that?
Buddy,
that's
come on.
That's 20 mana, right? 18 mana, what is it?
18 mana?
Yeah,
that's, I mean,
fine.
It's funny how it just, cards look very different. Like when I see a card, I have a visceral reaction based on where I've seen it. And Purphoros is a card that I've seen in Commander combo decks, where it's just like, as soon as this card hits the table, we're all going to die pretty shortly. And it's like, well, in this cube, this is actually going to play probably very, very differently. And it's going to be a little bit more of a build around that's going to be part of this machine that's going to take some work to put together. So, yeah, I mean, I think that's an interesting inclusion here.
I really hope that Purphoros, the existence of Purphoros, means that Krenko's Command is a busted Magic card. You know, that to me brings a smile to my face. Yeah, I think that's so funny. Like, Krenko's Command was a cut I made recently where it satisfies probably two or three archetypes, and I'm just hoping that it's a decent card that you're stoked to put in your deck. Stuff like that is what makes me excited, rather than your generic, like, two-drop Inti or whatever, you know?
Yeah. The other thing I'll say about this that I think it doesn't get said enough in cube design circles is acknowledging that, like, sometimes you want to do something for a little while, right? Sometimes you want to have a card in the cube that, does it belong entirely based on the stated goals? Maybe not. Is it too powerful? Maybe so. But you just want to do it a few times, right? And I think there's always this focus on the cube as a like artifact, as a not in the magic sense, but in like the cube as a distilled expression of an idea, and it's like you're working towards this end state and not understanding that you're just it's a long journey. And if you want 6 months of that journey to be this is the 6 months we have this busted card in the cube and we just play with it, and then once we've all had our fill, we move on, that's also completely valid, I think.
You can imagine a scenario where I show up to game night on Wednesday with a printed out banned and restricted list. You know, I think that's a funny gag you could lean into. Like, all right, everyone, we've heard your complaints at R&D and Perforos is now banned from the
You give
cube,
a whole
right?
speech in the same style as the banned and restricted announcements.
Correct. And then we can all have a little ritual where we cast our condolences to Perforos and we never see the card again. Like that's
until
it's
you
true,
play
though.
The Perforos cube.
Correct. Exactly. The Perforos cube is then a nascent idea for a separate project. But I think that's true too. Like, I love that some of these cards will be there forever, and some of them will definitely rotate out. That's exactly part of the goal too.
There was a dumb little joke Anthony made, I don't know, 6 years ago at this point in his battle box, where he happened to have just traded somebody for a Snapcaster Mage. And he had his battle box, which was at the time, and still is, very low-powered. Like, you're basically playing Grizzly Bears versus Hill Giants with, like, a couple, you know, removal spells. And he was like, wouldn't it be fun just to put Snapcaster Mage in the battle box as a special guest?
I think it was the Locust God, or...
I thought I remembered it being... I don't know what it was, maybe, but...
Worm Coil Engine.
But it's really struck with me, the idea of, like... Yeah, that would be fun, you know, in a different way, not in like a, that was a really interesting game and what a compelling game design choice way, but like, yeah, that'd be a story moment, right?
It would be pretty funny to have somebody just draw the Locust God and just be like, what, this doesn't belong here.
Then you just do it.
And then they just cast it.
All right, let's jump in and do a pack one, pick one from your cube, Sam, and use that as a way to maybe jump off and talk about a couple more details here. I'll read all the cards out. As a reminder, we do have our cards mentioned page, so if you want to see the rules text for all of these cards, you can check out luckypaper.co/podcast/196. Yeah, 196/cards. It'll also be linked in the show notes. That'll have every card we've mentioned here in chronological order, and these will be grouped somewhere towards the bottom with pack one, pick one. The pack is The Binding of the Titans, Cryptic Caves, Colonian Hydra, Banishing Light, Maze Mind Tome, Cleanup Crew, Chart a Course, Eliminate, Mirage Mirror, Orzhov Pontiff, Eldrazi Skyspawner, Expressive Iteration, Ketria Triome, Dreadhorde Arcanist, and Arcus Acolyte. That's a new one for me. I hadn't seen that one before. You always see a new card whenever you draft a cube. It's one of the great joys. I'm actually, if it's all right with you, Sam, I'm going to ask for your thoughts on this first, because I want to hear your thoughts before we ruin it with ours.
No, I'm stoked. So this is a hard pack for me because, yeah, you start to see the webs of the intended design, and I want to kind of scrape those away and just go in fresh as if I'm sitting down and seeing all these cards for the first time. In general, my default when I go to a new draft environment, I love doing this with Retail Limited. Like when a set starts to preview, I don't read any cards. I like going into the pre-release with nothing. So I'm pretending that I know nothing about the cube here. My default is always to take removal. So I think like Eliminate jumps out at me. Dreadhorde Arcanist is like super strong and it kind of pushes me toward one of my favorite archetypes, which is like red-blue spells. Probably between those two, I could see an argument for Banishing Light in the same way, just like this catch-all, exile your opponent's best permanent. Between those three, I'm going to go Eliminate because that still lets me be flexible to play the way I love to play. So I'm taking Eliminate, which is destroy a creature, planeswalker with mana value 3 or less at instant speed for 1 and a black.
I'm jealous of your decisiveness. This is not how I approach opening a pack of Magic cards. A couple things stand out to me. I think that you mentioned, and sort of looking at the list, it does seem like removal is a little bit lighter than some of the environments that I've been playing, so Banishing Light definitely stands out to me as something that can just deal with anything.
And there are quite a few things up the curve here that yes. Eliminate won't hit. So yep. While Eliminate in subcubes, like mine, for example, plays is a pretty hard removal spell for 95% of what your opponents could play, yeah. Here it would really be a tempo thing. You'd be removing just a small thing and not their big bomb necessarily. Right.
So I feel like Banishing Light is a good direction to go in, but Ketria Triome, Expressive Iteration, and Colonian Hydra also all really stand out to me. I feel like today, and I'm not saying this is the right answer, but today me wants to take the Hydra and just try and make a big Hydra.
Both valid approaches. I like Sam staying open, taking a generic card that can go in any deck that can cast it. Anthony's commitment to the 5-mana boom boom with +1/+1 counters and
I'm
just trying to make it happen.
I'm looking forward to wheeling this Arcus Acolyte and having a great time with it.
I think you will probably wheel the Arcus Acolyte, probably. I look at this pack and there are three cards that jump out at me. The first two are the ones that are banned in Legacy, which is Dreadhorde Arcanist and Expressive Iteration, which could be power outliers here. I think Expressive Iteration is the much safer of the two because there's pretty much no environment where drawing 2.5-ish cards is not amazing for 2 mana. It's just so generically good that I feel like that will slot into my deck very nicely, but it is a gold card, which is much more of a commitment. Dreadhorde Arcanist is one of those cards that can be absolutely cracked or can be totally fair or could be totally awful, right? I haven't actually looked deeply at the list to know what kind of support there is for it. I'm not sure if I'm supposed to be just trying to prioritize 1-mana spells to pair with it, or if there are going to be an abundance of ways to increase its power to allow me to cast more expensive spells. That one is very context-dependent, but has a super high ceiling. The third card that jumps out to me is definitely Ketria Triome. It's worth noting there are no fetch lands in this cube. Well, no, typed fetch lands. I think there is Evolving Wilds and Ash Barrens and Prismatic Vista, but there's no way to fetch up the Triomes, so this will not play the same role as it plays in like a powerful Vintage or Legacy cube. But I do think starting on fixing is one of my defaults for a cube where I don't have a good grasp of it yet. Because what that will allow me to do is basically play any of the powerful gold cards that wheel pretty much if I'm able to like get enough fixing lands to kind of play a fair few colors. So I think those are the three options. If I was in a spicy mood a la Anthony, I would take the Arcanist and just try and make it happen. I think as is, I'm probably going to commit to the gold card right out of the gate and just take the Expressive Iteration, just as I really like drawing two cards. It's good.
I love the iteration choice because it's a card that has like a high skill ceiling and kind of a baseline floor to me. I've played with that recently in this red-blue deck I mentioned earlier that in moderns, like this blue-red is it deck that Reed Duke cooked up. And it is a card that on the surface is not as obvious at how strong it is. And so it does reward a little bit of learning how to play with that card specifically. If you know how to cast it and when to cast it and how to sequence it, it's very strong. And I think that that's going to be a level up moment for the newer players in my cube. Because again, on the surface, it's like, yeah, you draw a card and you're soft scrying in a certain way. But if you play it later down the line, you see how flexible it is and how powerful it is. So if you take the Triome here, Andy, you might wield the iteration and you get to do the old, have your cake and eat it too.
Depends on who's at the table. In our local playgroup, Expressive Iteration is never coming around.
Yeah, because there's probably context and high skill players in your playgroup, I imagine, right?
Well, I mean, I'm not even convinced I'm right that it's that good of a card here, right? And this touches on so many great points. One is that, yeah, I think this card is actually very hard to evaluate. I mean, you mentioned that Magic players are bad at evaluating cards in a vacuum. And I remember from spoiler season people being like, meh, chart a course, but two colors, why do I care? Which you can totally see how you arrive at that. And to be fair, I think I was kind of on that spectrum too. I was like, this is better than chart a course, but is it enough better to warrant a two-color slot in a cube? I don't know. Then, we find out that actually, yeah, it's kind of really messed up if you play it the right way. And so even, really skilled players took a long time to come around on it. But the next point is that Cube is the absolute best place, I think, to play these cards that might otherwise be problematic in 4 of Constructed, where I don't think, even if this card is really good, there's no way that this card is, too good for this Cube or it's going to, take over games, right? It's just draw two cards. It's, kind of a dinky little enabler that is just going to, make your game plan a little smoother. So as a 1 of copy in a cube like this, you get to just play the powerful banned card and it's totally fine, right? It's never going to be a huge problem, which is part of the fun of cube for sure.
Yeah, and to your point about the Triome, I was intentional about not including fetches for a couple of reasons. One, I didn't want mana to be too good. I kind of liked the constraints of a two color in a splash deck. Yeah. Two, I just want to eliminate some of that shuffling a library. That's probably going to be only in a couple of colors. So I do want the Triome to actually cost something. You do have to take a turn off if you want to play it, or it does pay off the games that go longer and the green decks that go longer, or whatever deck that might splash a Triome. and have a high impact as a cycling for 3 mana, which is a lot. You know, cycling 3 is way different than cycling 2 in my experience. So
for sure.
So I do want to kind of keep the power check, you know, the balance a little bit on those triumphs, which is why I didn't include any fetches that could go get them.
Yeah, I'm historically a fan of a lot of fixing relative to the normal amount of fixing people put in cubes. And I've actually like kind of gone to the mat defending the idea that having a bunch of fixing lands does not inherently make multicolored decks better, or, you know, the 4 or 5 color good stuff decks more likely to happen. But I do think that the nature of the fixing is much more likely to go that way. And I've played a lot of cubes that are on fetches and triomes, and I found it so incidentally easy with that setup to just splash a 4th or 5th color without even trying, right? I already had this triome because it was 2 of my colors, and then, of course, I'm taking fetch lands highly because they're so powerful and flexible, and oops, it just ends up that I have 4 red sources, so I guess I'm taking this, you know, blue-red-gold card in pack 3, even though I wasn't playing any red because it's just kind of free for me to do. But in this context, without fetches, which, by the way, I think your choices for not playing them are perfect, right? It makes total sense and shows your attentiveness to your context and your goals. I do think triumphs without fetches suffer from almost none of those problems, right? It just becomes a pretty flexible 2-color land that can go in, you know, any 3 of any of 2-color pairs, which I think is really nice.
Yeah, and I've been playing, again, this modern deck, and just the sequencing of having the ability to fetch and a turn for a 3-color land is like, gosh, it trivializes the splash. And I want everything to cost something in this cube, you know, either tempo or a little extra mana or a narrow application like Eliminate, where awesome in the early game and you're really sad to see it as a top deck late game.
Yeah, for sure. And what I really want to do is take this Ketria Triome, and then I'm going to get my Pearl Lake Ancient later, and that'll be picking up my Ketria Triome to cycle it later on when I have plenty of lands. That's my ultimate goal.
Buddy, that is the dream. Now you're speaking my language.
I'm looking at this Mirage Mirror and wondering, is that part of a particular dream or goal in this environment?
I love the mystery around a lot of the artifacts that I chose, like the artifacts. Why do I want to say the artifacts?
You can recast them with your Dreadhorde Archivist.
That's right, yeah. So the artifacts are just such a toolbox. I'm really curious to draft the cube, in part because most of the choices I made in that department don't have an explicit application. You know, aside from a couple of the obvious equipments, like I want those to feel the way they did in Brothers War Draft, where maybe you pick up a Chromatic Star or an Ichor Wellspring and you get a payoff for it later, or it's just this kind of dinky, fun to cantrip type of effect that makes your draws a little smoother. So I think Mirage Mirror fits perfectly in that. I have no clue if that's playable or if it's really good or if somebody finds a way to make that really strong and they get to feel smart. So there is absolutely no rhyme or reason as to why it's here, other than the fact that it presents this question mark about not just the draft, but the decks that it might show up in. So in a lot of the artifacts feel that way too. There's really no application for them. So
I think these kind of clone effects are actually kind of quietly great as a cube design tool at lower power levels. Like at a power level where you can afford to, you know, play a 3-mana artifact that doesn't immediately affect the board, it's really nice because Mirage Mirror on its face, like on a board state that's agnostic of any synergy in any kind of deck, it can, you know, threaten to block one of your opponent's creatures or something. Like it does things on an empty board. You can just make a copy of one of their lands and then, you know, use that on your next turn if you want. Like you can do cool stuff with Mirage Mirror that's like just generic and works. But then in any of the decks that have synergy where you actually are playing off of these, you know, combinations of build arounds and payoffs, it becomes part of your engine, right? You just make another copy of your cool payoff, and now your deck is doing more with that actual synergy piece. So I like the inclusion of that here, and I also love including cards where you're like, I don't know what anyone's going to do with this. I'm just going to put it in, sure, and find out.
I will correct you that you can't copy a thing for next turn, just so people don't write in. But yeah, I mean, Mirage Mirror is kind of like a card that I'm always excited to see because even though it doesn't look super powerful and maybe it's going to be hard to get it into decks, as soon as it's in play, it always does interesting, weird things. So I'm a big fan of that.
Yeah, and copy effects that don't siphon the Enter the Battlefield trigger, I also am kind of attracted to because some of these cards, they're so front-loaded in that way. So what is the deck that wants to copy your opponent's spells after they've already been on the battlefield, you know? What is a deck that you can't copy, like Mirage Mirror is so bad against Colonian Hydra, you know, but Mirage Mirror might be super good with
You just Dreadhorde Arcanist.
You just need to figure out a way to get a counter on that first, and then you can copy the Colonia the Hydra for profit.
Here we go, yeah. You know what I mean, though? Like, I think that it does... It's a little bit worse because a lot of the cards are front-loaded with ETBs.
Right.
Well, this is great. I am so excited to see you getting into cube design, having watched your videos for years and feeling like I resonated with how you approached the game. I was always like, why doesn't Sam have a cube? I feel like Sam would love having a cube. And so I'm glad to see that you've entered that chapter of your magic journey that you're starting the cube design thing.
Yeah, I'm stoked too. I've wanted to do it forever, and now there's a lot of application and reason to have one. And I'll say that, like, if you're on the fence about cube, like I said at the top, like, it's reinvigorated my love for Magic, and I'm actively paying more attention to previews because I have an explicit lens that I'm looking at these cards through that is maybe not the lens that most folks are. And I think if you own a cube, you approach preview season in a totally different way. Like, I can't stress enough how the prospect and the promise of a cube changes your look at a game that you've been playing for a long time. And that's already been kind of one of the coolest resonant effects for me from sitting down and just putting a bunch of cards in a box. So I highly recommend it. Again, I'm tuning into previews in a weird way, in a way that I never thought I would be able to. And I'm stoked to see where this goes after we get, you know, 10 drafts in, if I can get that many, right? That's the first goal, is just get 10 drafts in and see what happens.
Yeah.
Cue me going through all the new cards and Outlaws at Thunder Junction looking for things that are good in 100 Ornithopters. And I think there's a couple bangers.
That's so funny. Gosh, I can't wait to see that thing come alive, because that's a cube that I think is implicitly just about the design or the mechanical language of Magic. You're exploiting not the goofy thing that everyone has to attack with an Ornithopter. What you're really asking is, how do you abuse a free creature, right? And there, yeah, and all the ways that that matters. So the problem is I anticipate that that cube might be very exhausting to draft or play, but the gimmick is more than just a gimmick, and that's the cool part of it.
Yeah, I'm kind of in the same phase with that cube as you are with your cube right now, where I'm like still going through my list that I'm also starting to acquire with like trades from friends and people in like Discord communities. I've started putting it all together, but I'm also still getting up every morning and going over the list and saying, like, why did I have this in here? Or why didn't I have this other card in here? There's still a bunch of like obvious cards that are either being cut or added, and I don't know what it's going to be like to play. I truly don't. So that's going to be fun for me to figure out too.
Have you, really quickly, have you looked at like Twisted Image type effects? Is that part of the cube?
This is a bizarre coincidence.
It is so bizarre. Someone recommended me that card like an hour ago, and I was like, this is exactly what I was thinking of.
You're
and I
like,
was just saying this.
Why didn't I think about Twisted Image?
I was like, why didn't I think about Twisted Image? It's like the perfect card here, because it is obviously the level zero, right, is in a lot of cases. It's just like a clean removal spell. Someone tries to go pump their Thopter, you just kill it, and you get to draw a card, which is great. Then it also, like, I have this combat jerk thing I'm brewing here with Echoing Boon, and if you manage to pump your Thopters at all, then you can turn it into a way to both pump two Thopters and draw two cards for one mana. In a pinch, you can even just kill two of your Thopters and draw two cards in response to a board wipe or something if you want to. It's, like, the perfect card, and, yeah, the fact that you mentioned it is such a coincidence, because literally an hour and a half ago, I was like, Twisted Image! Shout out to Candelum in the MTGCoop.Discord for pointing me to that one, too.
I think that's a little bit of my remnants of experimenting with Forgetful Fish or Dandan.
Right.
In that certain cards kind of scream at you because of the central promise of there's only one creature here. So what cards are relative to that creature that makes them fascinating to play with? And I think in this cube, sometimes it's amazing. Sometimes it's a total dud. Sometimes it's a combat trick, which is really strange. I've never seen a Twisted Image like, you know, be the reason you win on your own creature. So I don't know. I think it's also like if I open Twisted Image in the Ornithopter when I'm drafting, I just kind of give a smirk. Like, of course this card's in here.
I like to imagine an Ornithopter seeing itself in a reflection and then dying, right? Isn't that kind of the flavor of that card? Like, what exactly is happening in Twisted Image's lore?
Yeah, the sentient Ornithopter who will have a name and some Roman symbols attached to it.
Like, Bob the Ornithopter perceives himself and is obliterated.
We've all been there, you know.
Oof, so true.
Awesome. Well, this is so great, Sam. We're going to obviously link your cube in the show notes. We've talked about extensively and would encourage everyone to go check it out. And it sounds like you're receptive to feedback. You want to open those floodgates, are you sure?
Oh, big time. I actually, that's another kind of muscle that you have to exercise when it comes to something like this is that it is not personal. You know, that's kind of the, sometimes your ego is a little bruised because someone attacks a favorite card or an archetype or just looks at your list and says, this isn't going to work. But I, after years and years of making stuff on the internet, you learn to take feedback really well and separate your own kind of feelings from it. So please give all the feedback. Someone apologized because they wrote a big, you know, response to my Twitter thread. I'm like, no, that's what I wanted. Thank you so much for that. So feedback is always welcome, even if you want to just say that you hate Magic cards and all of them that are in my cube. Fine, go ahead.
I will say that it's not the outcome for everybody that making a bunch of content on the internet makes them really good at receiving feedback. That's maybe just kind of unique to you. So kudos to you for letting the bad stuff just roll off your back and hearing the good stuff.
Trying my best. It's a daily struggle for sure.
Oh, we know all too well. All too well. I would be very shocked if anybody listening to this podcast has not watched a Risk Studies video. So I don't know how much we have to pump your YouTube channel, but if you haven't watched Sam's videos, go check them out on YouTube. They are the best of the best. Maybe, Sam, can you recommend like a deep cut favorite video of yours that maybe isn't top of the list in terms of views you think people might not have seen, but you want to point them to?
I think one that keeps giving is the Gonti video. I know that I found out through some digging that you resonated with that video and you've made a cube that embraces the sort of spirit of that.
Yes.
That is a video that has had an afterlife that I did not really expect and people keep coming back to. I got an email recently from someone that was like, I found your channel recently and I kept scrolling over the Gonti video because it just did not appeal to me in terms of the thumbnail or the title. And they're like, actually, this is now my favorite video of yours. So I think that one speaks a little bit to not something that you might expect from magic culture or whatever have you. So that's one I always kind of point folks to. If you really want to go deep on like a journey, I still really like the Saga video that I made a long time ago. I think that was a cool one. The Red Deck Wins video is one of my all-time favorites as well. And those are a little bit off the beaten path. So those three are like videos that I still like. Most of the other videos I'm just done with. So if you want to
know.
Yeah, I'm just like, I don't care about them anymore. But those ones kind of had over time have like, all right, I'm still okay with this one.
I'm sympathetic to that. We will occasionally get somebody that's like, oh, I found your podcast and decided to go back and start listening from episode one. And I'm like, no, God, no, don't do that. Work backwards, if anything. And then you know when to stop when it, you know, gets less good. But yeah, that's the nature of making things online. And everyone should definitely check out Risk Studies. And we'll definitely link those videos specifically in the show notes for everybody. And yeah, the Gonti video, I was aware. The thing is, like, I'm also, you know, a sicko. I'm deep in magic. So I was actually aware of the deck, of Doug's deck, before you made the video about it. But you contextualized it and explained it in such a way that, like, totally changed my perception of it. I was like, okay, yeah, the guy that is a, you know, card seller has, like, a gimmick deck where he puts a bunch of busted cards in a deck for fun. And then the way you talked about the values behind it just totally changed my perception of it. So I'm sure a lot of people first found out about it through you, but I just had my perspective shift by your cool video on it.
Well, thank you. I'm glad it resonated with you. I guess the last video I'll plug, because this is a cube audience, is the one on Forgetful Fish, because Nick Floyd has been doing the cube thing for 20 years with his small project Dandan. And Dandan itself is also kind of in the spirit of like magic is a language more than it is a game.
Yes.
If you haven't played Dandan, I think Dandan is the tiniest version of a cube experience. It's so wieldable. It's so like plastic in the way that it creates scenarios where you have 15 minutes to play a game of magic, but no one has a deck. Like, I just love the promise of it, of like, hey, there's a magic experience in this box. We don't even have to have separate decks to play. But if you're a cube designer or if you live in the world of cube, I think you'll look at that video in a slightly different way and say, all right, we've been doing this for a long time, and Dandan is its own, you know, 100 ornithopters in a box type of experience. So I'd point to that one as well.
I remember specifically from that video, you go back and find like the original post on whatever forum where he was talking about this idea and how it got like two replies that were like, ah, cool, seems interesting, maybe I'll try it. And I flash back to I counted last, I have like 42 cubes in my Cube Cobra, right? Like,
whoa.
The number of just like, you know, dumb ideas that you have that you like, you know, take a shot at. And I think Dandan is a great example of this like experimental space that a lot of cube designers are playing in, where they are acknowledging that, well, this is not going to be part of any structured format, so I can kind of do whatever I want. And what if I build a battle box or modified some rules or put 100 stupid ornithopters in the cube. It's definitely cool when some of those things like take hold and find an audience and resonate with people.
Yeah, it's proven itself. There's been a gap between that forum post and people championing the format and bring it to the forefront, and my video explored that a little bit. The biggest reward ever was going to MagicCon Minneapolis and meeting Nick Floyd. He kind of like told me he was going to be there, and then he came up and he was like, "Hi, I'm Nick Floyd." I'm like, "Gosh, you are a legend to a lot of us. Like, you don't think that what you did is super impactful, but it really is part of the history and culture of magic in a really cool way." So I'm very honored I got to play Dan Den with Nick Floyd. I had him sign a couple of my cards, you know. It's just a really good feel-good story too, I think.
That's why we love Cube, and the fact that there's all of these subcultures or like micro communities within magic, right? That magic is just this kind of canvas on which you can do something completely unrelated to any structured format that Wizards has ever put out, using only cards that are 20 plus years old, and it can find a new audience and a new purchase years later after you first introduced the idea. That's why this game is so cool.
I'm gonna plug your playmat. I bought one. Cube will outlive magic. That's what you say, and that's what you've proclaimed as one of your thesis statements, and I agree entirely. This will be, I've always said, Cube will be what we're doing in the old folks' home more than anything else.
I think about that sometimes too. Like, man, when we're retired, is it just gonna be people playing video games and magic in like retirement homes? And I think probably so.
I can't imagine a world where I'm not playing magic when I'm older. You know, that's another realization I've come to over the course of my 10 plus years playing this game. It's like, no, I'm going to play magic until I'm no longer on this planet. So whatever building that's in, then so be it.
Very generous of you to mention the playmat, and I'm glad you did. This episode's actually going to come out the Monday of the last week of the pre-order, so if you want one of those playmats, you've got 4 or 5 days from this episode being published to get a pre-order in. And the response has been really great. I'm really touched by everybody that has reached out and said how much it means to them and is excited to get their hands on a copy, so thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
I'm all in. Appreciate it, too. Thank you for designing that. I'm stoked to get mine.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Lucky Paper Radio. All of our music is produced by DJ James Nasty. All the magic cards are produced by Wizards of the Coast. This podcast is produced by Sam finally deciding to take the plunge and build a cube and then coming on to talk with us about it. This has been fantastic, Sam. Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate it.
And, you know, we got to have you back sometime if you want. We can just talk more about art. We mentioned before recording that, you know, you'd listened to the art episode and thought it was an interesting conversation and wanted to continue it. And I was just glad that you didn't listen to it and turn off the podcast and never talk to us ever again. So we're happy to talk about art whenever you want, if you want to come back.
Absolutely. I'd love to come back and chat about art or about the next iteration of this cube, you know. We'll line up a schedule again.
I'd just love to hear about how that actual first playtest goes and sort of, yeah, I mean, get that sort of before and after perspective, because I feel like that is just such a powerful moment, that first draft.
I hope I get to send you all a photo of Pearl Lake Ancient on the battlefield. So
I look forward to it. I look forward to it keenly.
Bye.
Why have you not started a podcast? Because you would love to have a podcast. And this whole studio is down here.
I don't know. Because I would never be able to edit it. Because I don't like to listen to myself talk. I just talk at everyone else and they have to listen to me.
You just like to be heard talking by other people?
Yeah, you got it.
Well, you
got
to hire an editor then.
That costs money. Well, you would have to start a podcast. Money, please. Why don't we start? We could start a... Do you want to start another podcast, Andy, with your wife? I don't know.
Okay, well, you don't know.
I'll think about it.
You just love talking into a microphone. Get out of here!
Woo!
You're out.